This is Joseph Gervasi. I'm here with Dan Yeaman, and today is August 20th, 2013. We're recording this interview at my house in lovely Roxborough, Philadelphia, and this is part of Loud Fast Philly. Hello, Dan.
Hey, how are you?
Thank you for coming out. I know that I was extremely annoying in trying to compel you to come out here.
It's all right. I know you don't leave your house much.
I never leave my house. I'm always here. So we'll begin as we customarily do with baby Dan. Where were you born and when?
June 17th, 1968 in Manhattan.
Okay. How long did you live in Manhattan?
Not very long. We lived in Yonkers and probably Brooklyn for a little while and outside of Chicago for a little while, upstate New York for a little while, and then landed in northern New Jersey by the time I was 8.
Okay, what is all of this moving about?
My parents work, mostly.
What kind of work did they do?
My father has a doctorate in chemical engineering and was doing that at a time when nuclear power kind of started to be a business and a national interest. And so he, there were no nuclear engineers because there was no such thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
this is just post World War II?
Oh, no, this is like, he finished his degree in the 60s.
Okay.
But there were no real, you know, there were people that, there were structural engineers that I think built the plants, and there were scientists, you know, nuclear scientists, but they needed engineers that, that had specific skill sets to deal with aspects of nuclear power. And, you know, he had some experience. He always said that, like, he got stuck in the middle of grad school and ended up taking twice as long as he should have to finish his doctorate. And, you know, just got, like, I think probably depressed.
Mm-hmm.
The period of time when a lot of pretty special people were getting assassinated.
Uh-huh.
And I think he got pretty depressed, and then he ended up having to, like, you know, his funding didn't carry him through the whole thing, so he ended up having to work in this gamma processing lab, and turned out the skill set from that job, which he only had because he got depressed and didn't finish his degree on time,
mm-hmm.
ended up making him the perfect candidate for these kind of fledgling nuclear engineer jobs
mm-hmm.
that were coming into being in the 60s. And so he was doing that.
Do you think there was a progressive spirit involved in the early development of nuclear power for...
Absolutely. I mean, I think the scientists, at least, you know, there's a lot of, like, panic about it, but the scientists involved really believed it was much better for humanity and the environment than the current, you know, way that the current means of getting electricity.
Right.
And I think most scientists still believe that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not convinced that nuclear power is a worse option than the ways we've traditionally gotten most of our power.
Right. Is your father still involved in the field?
He's retired.
Okay.
He's 80 now.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so he moved a bunch and then settled. He went to work for a company in New York, and then we ended up, and we were living in Yonkers, and then he ended up, same company, but work, it was an engineering contracting company or a consulting company, and they ended up on this job that was federally funded, and it was happening at Princeton University, and it was like a fusion test reactor, and their company was working with Grumman and some other, you know, aerospace companies to design and build this thing, and he was working on that, so we moved, he got sick of commuting to Princeton from Yonkers, and we moved to Westfield.
Mm-hmm. So what was Westfield like when you were growing up there?
It was a really conservative, like the ideal Reagan-era suburb.
Right.
It had definitely had like a a right and wrong side of the tracks, although I want to be really clear that the entire town is upper middle class.
Okay.
But there is like an old money, like traditionally pretty waspy side of town, and there was like a more newly developed side of town, literally on the other side of the tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely, also by the time we lived there, had a pretty large Jewish population, but I knew I'd heard stories that I was raised Jewish. I'd heard stories that we lived on the south side, which is the newer side of town, and I'd heard stories that just a few years before we moved there, people we knew couldn't get shown houses in certain parts of town, like in the as recently as the mid 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you couldn't see a house near the tennis club or the country club.
And this was the Jews that weren't allowed
Jews weren't allowed to look at houses.
But they didn't have to wear a little yellow star or something polo shirt.
Not on their polo.
Yeah.
No, so it was a pretty conservative town. It was a terrible place to live during the Reagan years, which is when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about young Dan growing up, and what were your interests, and what kind of brought you ultimately into your interest in punk?
Probably science fiction.
But who are your guys?
Asimov, Roger Zelazny.
You're the Amber Books?
Yeah. Robert Heinlein. And then a lot of, I obsessively read all of their stuff. And then Asimov had like a digest monthly science fiction digest, mm-hmm, of short stories. And I would read that and then, kind of like the way you discover new bands by listening to college radio. I'd be like, oh, I like this story, so let's see what else that person wrote.
I went through a very similar process, right. So it's nice to hear that.
And so much of, so much of science fiction, the science fiction I read was kind of utopian.
Mm-hmm.
And it was before, like, dystopian literature fiction came into vogue. And I mean, it's not like it's all utopian, but I think that the thread that led me to punk is like science fiction. There's a sense of possibility that things could be different,
mm-hmm,
that things that are terrible now could be different.
Right.
But also the smartest stuff also was, critiquing the most fucked up aspects of human, modern society.
Yeah.
And in capitalist culture, and sort of depicting futures that were hyperbolic, kind of extensions of the worst tendencies of the present. Which I think I even understood then that critique was important and fit with the way I saw the world.
Mm-hmm. So then,
even when I was 10. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so this eventually dovetailed into an interest in music.
I always had an interest in music. I don't know where that... I mean, there was always music in my house, but it was only classical. That was the only thing my parents listened to.
Okay.
Which I never got into.
Yeah, even to today?
Yeah. I mean, I'll put it on for peaceful times.
Yeah.
But not to listen actively.
Mm-hmm.
So we were surrounded by music, and it was, like, important to my family. Music and books.
Mm-hmm.
Everything, every room had music and books.
Yeah, that's nice. Because it would certainly be a sort of an intellectually nurturing environment, which certainly some people, never have access to.
Absolutely. Even my grandfather, who I think had to leave school at 14, he was an immigrant, and he'd been working since he was 14. He had, like, four times this many books in his Brooklyn apartment and had read more than, most people in my nuclear family have graduate degrees, and he'd read more than all of us. He was a total autodidact,
mm-hmm,
and that was always a part of the culture of our family.
Yeah, that's a great set of DNA then to inherit, because it certainly is fostering you exploring your brain in different directions.
He also lived to 105 and remained physically active and independent until he was like 100.
Wow, that's impressive.
Like cruising around Coney Island. He's an interesting dude.
I'd like to interview him.
Yeah.
From the grave.
He's a pretty interesting guy.
So was there a music that you were drawn to prior to punk that eventually dovetailed into?
The first, hard rock. I mean, the first record I bought with my own money was the first Kiss album.
Uh-huh.
which I think also predisposed me towards punk, only because there was a mythology around it that I found really captivating. Like, they were in makeup and costume, and you didn't know what they looked like.
I guess this would have been prior to their kind of unveiling.
Oh, yeah. This is 1977. Yeah. You know? And so, like, and they had, you know, they used their names, but they had, like, this each character had a mythology to it, and there was a lot of mystery and obfuscation, and it's the same reason I loved Wu-Tang Clan immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And something about that sense of mystery made me at least, it's like, I think if you find a cave in your backyard, you're like, you know you're going to spend every fucking day exploring that cave.
And the cave just keeps on going.
Yeah, it keeps going. And so, like, I went down that rabbit hole. You know, I wanted to know everything. So it engages you in a different way, not just the music, but the sense of mystery. You want to know about the people and the mythology. And
I imagine it takes a fair bit of work on your part at the time, because in a pre-internet age, you really kind of have to really seek and find.
Oh, yeah, especially as a kid. You've got to, like, go into, like, pharmacies and comic book shops and look for magazines and you know, just go to record stores, ask questions. Dumb little kid bothering the guy behind the counter at the music staff.
Yeah. But they all know that this little seed is planted.
Oh, sure. So. I mean, they're at that point, you know, they're happy to... People that worked in record stores in the 70s were happy to talk to you about music all day.
Yeah.
Same as now, actually. That hasn't changed at all.
Yeah, that is certainly a constant.
So, and then from that, I got into... I don't know if I can remember it all in an entirely linear fashion, but... I definitely got into hard rock, and the next thing I kind of remember being really into was Rush.
Mm-hmm.
But for a while, any record any kid in my neighborhood brought home of any, including disco, or just like sit around the record and stare at it and listen to it over and over again.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, what's happening here?
Yeah. It's such an immersive experience to take in all the elements, the packaging, the music.
And I remember one time, I had such limited, there was no pop culture in my house because my parents are nerds and like scientists, and they didn't. And my mom has a master's degree in child psychology, and they only listened to classical music. We had a black and white TV, pre-cable until, there was no cable until I was in middle school. It didn't exist, but...
Mm.
I've only seen my parents watch PBS,
right.
You know, like to this day. And so there was no sense of like, there's nothing with the New York Times in my house,
mm-hmm.
right? And PBS. So, I remember one time I had an Aerosmith record. I liked Aerosmith. And I remember finding this thing in the Times that once a week they published like the top 10. I don't know whose top 10 it was. I don't think it was Billboard. It was like the top 10 records or whatever. And I remember like writing down the bands on that and adding to the list of bands I knew and then asking one of my babysitters if I had gotten all of them.
All the bands?
Yeah, all the bands.
The band, yeah.
And she just was like, no, there's a lot more going on. I was like, what? What? And then it was Rush and you know, a combination of like stuff that I just got into and the stuff that was on the radio that was cool. I thought the Cars first few records were awesome.
Mm-hmm.
The first band I was in middle school covered like stuff we liked and anything that was easy to play. So like certain Rolling Stone songs, certain Rush songs, which were not easy.
No, I'm sure.
Certain Cars songs.
So you were playing guitar then?
Yeah.
Yeah, when did you start doing that?
13.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're taking lessons?
No, pretty quickly, I found my mom's old guitar. My mom, like, learned, like, folk songs at some point when I was, like, really young, and she used to bring the guitar camping, and she'd actually, like, sing around the campfire, like, ridiculous. And I remember this one memory of her coming home crying because she'd been walking home from her guitar lesson and she tripped and fell and her guitar broke.
Mm-hmm.
It's the neck snapped, and my dad, the engineer, just like got a bunch of wood glue and all these clamps and built this apparatus to hold it.
He didn't make it into a loop, did he?
No, he just fixed it.
Red.
And then like my mom abandoned it eventually, and then like when I was in junior high, I found it in a closet, and I like just picked it up. I didn't know how to tune it, but just on the one string, I just started like figuring out like Who song, like songs by the Who. I love the Who.
Mm-hmm.
Or like
And
I started figuring out, like, oh, I was like, oh, that's just Can't Explain. That's cool. And my parents are like, oh, he has, like, an ear. And so they're really supportive of whatever, you know. Like, so they're just like, well, guitar lessons. You want guitar lessons? And then I had guitar lessons. I studied with a classical guitarist who was cool. She would, like, do a combination of making me learn theory and practice rudiments. And then if I was interested in learning a song, she would learn it. She'd figure it out, but then she'd do it in musical notation. I'd have to learn it by reading.
Oh, so you could read then?
Yeah, then I could, yeah.
You can't read anymore?
No.
Yeah. I guess it doesn't make much of a difference at this point.
Punk ruined a lot of disciplines for me.
Very sorry.
But the fact that she taught me theory ended up being really important later on. I was also really into The Police.
Mm-hmm.
And the first Police album was really punk.
Yeah.
Try listening to it again at some point.
I attempted to push all forms of the Police out of my life.
Sorry about that.
Yeah,
they're a pretty inventive band. And then you know, in like eighth grade, maybe I got exposed to The Clash.
So was that? Did you consciously know that this was punk? Like this was something that was its own little scene, or actually, you know,
yeah, I mean, I didn't know it was a scene. I just knew it was music that was different.
Right. So you knew there was music apart from, say, the other records.
I knew it was cooler than what we were doing because this other band in middle school, you know, and there's like Battle of the Bands and or Showcase things that they would do in the gymnasium a few times a year, and they'd have bands set up like all over. And this other band of kids I knew, who like had older brothers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the oldest brother. They had older brothers, and they were, like, doing Clash songs. And I was like, holy shit. This is, like, really immeasurably cooler than what we're doing.
Yeah, yeah. Do you remember what Clash record it was that you had discovered? And was it the first?
I think I got exposed to London Calling and the first LP simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have been when London Calling was out. Or maybe just when Sandinista came out.
Okay. Sandinista's what, like 82? Maybe?
Yeah.
Something like that. Something like that. Yeah. That sounds about right.
Yeah. Because I remember that song, Police on My Back.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Train in Vain was on the radio. It was like an actual single.
Yeah. It's hard to imagine today. But yeah.
Somewhere in between those two records, but I just had a friend who had another friend who I don't think was in any of these bands, but had an older brother, a couple older brothers, and we borrowed the guitar from like the junior high like band room had a couple of electric guitars you could sign out,
mm-hmm.
and he had this Hagstrom guitar with like 40 switches on it. It's like an old cheap surf guitar. And he taught me, he knew, like, Clamp Down and Death or Glory, and he taught them to me. And then, I think at the same time, Clash City Rockers.
Yeah, yeah. So do you begin to become aware of other punk bands at this time, or look for them?
Yeah, I think The Jam, we got exposed to The Jam pretty quickly, and and because of The Jam, then there's this weird overlap where, like, because of The Jam and Rush, I bought a bass.
Because
I got pretty infatuated with what both Geddy Lee and Bruce Foxton were doing.
Right, on the bass.
The bass.
Yeah. Did you take lessons on the bass as well?
Okay. No, just, if you know.
If you play guitar, I imagine.
If you play guitar, you could play the bass. You just had to practice because it took more strength.
Yeah.
And deeper calluses.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, so there was that.
Right.
And then pretty soon after, it's hard to remember the timeline at this point, but, you know, if I could sit in front of my record collection, I could tell you what, sort of how it came. I think ended up with, like, that Susie singles collection, Once Upon a Time, and at some point found College Radio. But there was some time in there when I just really basically had word of mouth to go on. Mm-hmm. But there were two stations that we could get pretty easily. One was the Rucker station, RSU, and one was Staten Island College, WSIA. And, you know, it was like, at this point, the early 80s, and so, like, everyone with a college radio show is playing punk.
Yeah, yeah.
Or hip-hop. Mm-hmm. And, so I would just come home after school and put a cassette in and record and then go out and play and then come back and, like, listen to it and then have a notepad. I wait till the DJ comes on and be like, you went through the same thing.
Oh, I could completely relate to that. Yeah, KDU.
Yeah, so Minor Threat, Suicidal. But also, like, they would play early Elvis Costello and the Attractions right after a live version of Institutionalized. Mm-hmm. And then, like, the weirdest song on the Husker Du record. You know, they'd play that Diane song about Ed Gein. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. On Metal Circus. And that was the first Husker Du song I heard. And it's like a dirge, you know. And then I heard the rest of the Husker Du stuff. Like, and I was like, whoa. But I loved Husker Du. Minor Threat, Husker Du, Suicidal. Buzzcocks, definitely. What Do I Get was on there. Generation X. That was life-changing.
Yeah,
I was in love with the song Kiss Me Deadly, and I finally found the Generation X record, and I was like, oh my god, this is the best thing that ever happened to me.
Was it a process trying to find these records then that you were hearing on this cover?
Totally. Yeah, I mean, we had a record store in town with a limited punk section, and you just got what was there.
Yeah, were the people there at all in tune to that? Because a lot of times record stores would be run by old hippies who didn't necessarily know, you know, what was coming out of England at the time or whatever.
I think by then I wasn't asking questions. I was just looking. Mm-hmm. I was mostly getting my questions answered by kids with older brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
And then just looking for stuff that looked cool. But somehow there was stuff that looked cool that I never got into until later. Like, Misfits records were captivating, but I never bought a Misfits record back then.
What do you think was why didn't you pick those up and they're around?
Why didn't I? I don't know. Something about it probably seemed, even then, a little hokey.
Mm-hmm. So there's definitely a lot of hokiness there.
Yeah.
Although it's an appealing hokiness.
It is, definitely. But I don't know. I was less into obvious hooks back then. And although The Clash is a lot of obvious hooks. I don't know why I would like The Clash and not The Misfits. It doesn't make any sense. I liked what The Clash was singing about. Like, I knew it was political.
Yeah. So was there a political thread that was sort of entering your life at this time?
Yeah, I mean, as I started, I had a pretty good school system. So I had, like, people that, even in elementary school, that were, like, having us do projects where we read the New York Times and, like, did projects on, like, current events, you know, local and international. So, and, you know, and then there were... This was in my household, so, like, I was aware of, like, I remember being really aware of the hostage crisis in Iran, and I just remember becoming aware that Reagan was a piece of shit, and, like, everything I, like, kind of believed about freedom was, like, being pissed on. And I was less cynical about the... I didn't have any cynicism about the entire political process and how limited our choices were. But I knew that those like, the Republicans were fucks. And they were, like, just starting to get into bed with the religious right as a way of kind of, like, consolidating their base. Yeah. And, like, so there was the moral majority, which was a thing, like a... which is an evangelical kind of, like, or pre-evangelical by today's standards, but this guy Jerry Falwell had spearheaded this organization called the Moral Majority, which is like a pan-Christian, right-wing morality police. At least that's what they wanted to be.
Yeah, yeah. He had quite a dramatic fall when his time came.
He did. It was beautiful.
He fell well. Did you grow up, I mean, when I was growing up in the early 80s, I was aware of sort of the imminent threat of nuclear war.
Oh, yeah. That was like, I didn't think we'd live to see 30.
Yeah, it always seemed like that little doomsday clock was just like edging closer to midnight.
Yeah, there was that. Like, the Cold War was definitely, like, scary. Mm-hmm. But I didn't see it in terms of, like, good guys and bad guys. I saw it in terms of, like, crazy people who would, like, fuck us all to save face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or to, like, avoid looking weak. Like, I was aware of, like, the part of the, like, the Reagan ideology of peace through strength, which I thought was, like, even at 15, sounded so dumb to me. Like,
there's also the thought of the MAD, the mutually assured destruction, would surely keep us from blowing each other apart, which I suppose maybe it did.
It probably did.
Yeah.
But I definitely became aware of... And this might have been because I was curious about what the Clash was singing about, but the shit that was going on, you know, post-Vietnam in Central America in the name of fighting communism.
Trying to grow El Salvador,
And where we were sort of like interfering directly in, you know, like populist democratizing kind of events.
Mm-hmm.
Usually to uphold kind of American-friendly puppet dictators who are going to squelch any kind of socialist Marxist activity that was going on. That's sort of like the hypocrisy seems so obvious. You know, like we are a country founded on revolution, and here we were like interfering with revolutions close by.
Right. Yeah, nobody wanted the creeping tendrils to creep ever closer to the U.S.
Yeah. Like, communism in action was pretty totalitarian and scary, but communism in theory is pretty utopian.
Yeah, but in action, it winds up being equally, you know.
But I understood the difference. You know, I don't think 16-year-olds are too dumb to understand that, like, these ideas are meant to be liberating, and like maybe they'll do a better job in Nicaragua than they did in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, maybe. Or maybe they wind up in their own version of a gulag.
Yeah, who knows? But it's their right to figure it out.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Mm-hmm.
And,
So did you begin to identify yourself as punk, you know, around this time?
I don't know. I thought of it that way because I still wasn't really aware of... This is all stuff that was happening somewhere else, you know?
Yeah.
I certainly wasn't aware of, like... Until I went to my first show, I wasn't aware of, like, a scene that was currently existed... That currently existed close by that I could participate in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the suburbs were still pretty isolated. Right. I mean, I was allowed to go into the city on the train.
Which would be New York.
By myself, yeah, New York. Sorry, we lived, like... A half an hour train ride from New York. Probably as close as you grew up. As close as you were to Philly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Sorry. I'm talking about the city and it's a little bit... I'm totally a Philadelphian at this point. It's been 21 years. But when I'm reminiscing and I talk about the city, it's definitely...
Yeah, New York.
Yeah. So the city wasn't like a scary place. I mean, my folks were both born and raised in the Bronx. So like... They took us into the city pretty much every weekend when I was little and availed ourselves of all the kind of cultural opportunities. Like, I was in the Museum of Natural History probably 100 times.
That's great.
Before I finished elementary school. And, you know, art, you know, the Guggenheim and the MoMA and the Met and all that stuff. A lot of art museums, art exhibits. And then I was, you know, by the time I was... 15, I was allowed to go in by myself, but I didn't know, you know, the New York Times doesn't have ads for shows at SOBs or CBGB, you know, like, so at least it didn't then. It wasn't until I found out where I could get the Village Voice that I started being aware of that. But somebody took me into to New York to see a free show in Central Park in 1984, and it was a Rock Against Racism show, and it was Cause for Alarm, Roxanne Shanté, and Reagan Youth.
Oh, nice.
And that was it for me. That sealed my fate.
So I imagine you're probably seeing the chaotic movement.
Oh, it was like terrifying. There's like bleeding skinheads like coming out of the pit, but like also there's all this stuff that I was like pissed off about, and there's the guy, there's a singer of Reagan Youth on stage, like this like crazy looking bearded dude just like marching around Sig Heiling. But I clearly, I mean, I understood what he was talking about.
I know he was. You didn't think he was a fascist.
No, I thought he was ridiculing like Reagan era American culture, quote unquote, which I thought, you know, was pretty awesome. And so I was kind of sold after that. I was like, oh, this is like happening, you know, and I missed Minor Threat by like a year. Like if I'd been a little more aware or a little more of a sense of, like, if it certainly had been the internet age, I would have, you know, I would have been on that shit a couple years earlier. But what can you do?
Yeah, I'm sure you can rattle off hundreds of bands who, you know, young people would be crying to hear that you saw that they missed, so.
Perhaps.
So then do you begin in earnest to go to these shows, and were you...
Not for another couple of years, not until I went to college.
Okay, so then what year is that?
86.
Okay. So did you have friends when, you know, prior to that who were into punk? And were you kind of, you know, physically defining yourself, you know, with weird hair or clothes or something? Right? So you kind of would dress like fairly normally?
Yeah, pretty standard. Not preppy. I hated preppy kids.
No polo shirts.
No. My parents would have laughed at me if I asked for that stuff anyway.
Right. So you went into college, and then it begins to kind of, you start to immerse yourself in the active scene of the time.
Yeah.
And where were you going to college?
University of Michigan in Ann Arbor.
So what was going on over there?
They were much less into, I mean, I met a bunch of kids that were like into punk and had been playing in punk bands already, but people's interests seemed to be shifting there. Stuff could still be regional then, you know.
Mm-hmm.
People's interest was really had moved towards what was happening on Sub Pop, which was already, you know, a functioning label in the mid-80s or mid late 80s. So people were really into, like, all the punk hardcore kids were really into like either weirder stuff, like what the Butthole Surfers were doing, or like Green River, like early Sub Pop bands.
Yeah.
Green River, Mudhoney.
Yeah.
You know, there were still like Circle Jerks. I saw the Circle Jerks the first weekend I lived in Ann Arbor.
Yeah, that's a good welcoming.
Yeah. And that was amazing.
Did Keith Morris have the hideous dreadlocks at the time?
I can't remember. It was great, though. I saw Sonic Youth like a dozen times the first like couple years I was there, when they were like playing in places the size of your living room.
Mm-hmm.
And that was exciting. It's like a guitar player watching them deconstruct what guitar was all about.
Yeah, yeah. Does that begin to plant any kind of a seed in your head, you know, seeing that? Yeah.
Well, it was cool to be really getting into East Coast punk and hardcore, but be in a place where I couldn't access it. And so I was getting exposed to everything else that people who had already like kind of been going to hardcore shows since the early 80s had moved on to. So like, interestingly enough, I got exposed to the New York like noise scene in Michigan. So early Sonic Youth, when there's like a drone kind of noise thing going on, and a band called Live Skull that for some reason no one ever talks about, although I think they were like immensely influential. Really dissonant, kind of mechanical sounding band. Swans. You know, that's those people that I met from there, you know, turned me on to Mission of Burma and Wire, and, you know, less, like a lot of post punk.
Mm-hmm. So I guess this saves you from taking too myopic a view.
Yeah, it saved me from becoming like a skinhead.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But it was good. But I was dying to see Gorilla Biscuits, and I was in Michigan like 8 months out of the year.
Yeah.
But then what would happen is I'd go see whatever. Like anything weird and loud, I would go. There's a club called The Blind Pig. It's probably about the size of the first floor of your house.
Uh-huh.
And everybody played there. Everybody that came through. So I got to see all the Sub Pop bands before that shit got famous.
Yeah.
So Nirvana on their first tour, Soundgarden on their first tour, Tad on their first tour, all the Homestead bands. I got to see Naked Ray Gun. I got really into Naked Ray Gun because the Midwest, the people were like, this is our band, you know?
Right. And they're fucking fantastic.
Yeah, and Naked Ray Gun was next level because they could have just been, they could have just taken the easy route and been the American Stiff Little Fingers with those big hooks, those big hooks.
Yeah.
But two-thirds of their songs would just be fucking weird, dissonant, like misanthropic something.
Yeah.
And like, so those records were genius. I was just like, wow, what are they doing? So, but then the first Dang Nasty record came out, and that was kind of life-changing because it was really dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
It took like what Minor Threat was doing dynamically to the next level.
Right.
But so I was going to all these shows, whatever was, like I said, whatever was weird and loud coming through Ann Arbor. Sometimes it was hardcore bands. Like, I saw Poison Idea. I was in love with Dinosaur Jr. Even before, like, the first record, it was Dinosaur,
right?
And then they got sued by some hippie band.
Yeah.
And so I have a version of the first album that's just, that doesn't have the Junior.
Mm-hmm.
And they were fantastic. They were so awesome and aggressive. And like, I saw them a lot in Ann Arbor. But then I would go back. The school year was always done by like April 30th. So I was back May 1st and going to City Gardens every fucking week. And that was just like East Coast punk and hardcore.
Yeah, yeah. Now maybe you should explain, for those who haven't experienced City Gardens, a place of maybe sometimes dubious merits. Like, what was the City Gardens experience like?
Terrifying.
For you?
Constantly terrifying.
I mean, I would absolutely concur with that.
There were times early on when if I didn't get a parking spot close to the... You know, there was that big, long dirt lot next to it.
Uh-huh.
If I couldn't get a spot there, I had a couple times turned around and gone home because I was afraid to park further into the city than that.
The city, you could... Trenton was a complete
mess. Trenton's pretty
mess.
Economically devastated.
Yeah. There were always creepy dudes hanging around.
Trenton's one of those... I don't know what the rest of the country's like in this regard, but... I think of these like kind of B cities, like satellite cities right outside of big cities that were either very the economy was very industrial or were based on a port.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Trenton had a port, I think.
Yeah.
And had a lot of manufacturing. I mean, they have the bridge in Trenton. The bridge over the river has this big neon sign that says Trenton makes the world
takes.
So it's a manufacturing city, and when all those jobs moved south or abroad. Like in Philly, like in Camden,
like in Newark, like in
Patterson, the economy died. And then you just had like these devastated, half-abandoned cities. And especially the smaller ones, they had no other economy. They had no like intellectual economy to fall back on. You know, no schools, no business, really. There were towns where you could make a solid working-class living... working in a factory or working at the port, and then suddenly that just didn't exist anymore.
Yeah, I grew up in Camden County with the specter of Camden kind of looming over, and never, in no point of my life was that place actually active. Mm-hmm. You know, it had already been dead and just got increasingly...
And that was the beginning of also the question, like, does capitalism work? Like, if there's no regulation, I know, like, right-wing people hate talking about regulation, but... Like, if large businesses can do whatever they want to maximize profit, like, how does that work for regular people?
Often it doesn't.
Yeah. Like, a lot of communities were built around one major employer. And when that employer decides to move their production to Mexico...
Yeah.
What
do you expect it to
how
do?
How do you just, like, let the forces of history roll over people?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, that doesn't work out. So, anyway, Trenton's a scary place.
Yeah.
And there was also, you know, you had, like, suburban white kids traveling to, a largely African-American city that was kind of devastated economically. And... and the city just seemed kind of grim and abandoned. Mm-hmm. And like way scarier than the Lower East Side either, even, which is, you know, I was going to shows there too, and Lower East Side in the 80s was scary. Mm-hmm. To me, at least.
There was a huge drug epidemic that had moved through there.
Yes. Yeah. But Trenton had Nazi skinheads.
Yeah,
so many Nazi skinheads. I'm a Jewish kid from the suburbs.
Yeah.
And I understand the forces that conspire to like turn people in that direction. You know, economic devastation.
Stupidity.
But also sort of like, if you're left with no functioning economy in your community, and your community has been especially affected by economic devastation, and the level of education isn't particularly high, and things like things that people cling to when times are bad, like church and patriotism, mm-hmm. you know, further stupefy you.
Right.
Your kind of options are, in terms of trying to understand what's become of your community, it's either a critique of post-industrial capitalism mm-hmm. or like blame it on someone else.
Right. Yeah.
So what do you think? Where do you think people are going to go?
Yeah.
You know, like what's the easiest explanation?
Yeah.
So I understand why Atlantic City and Allentown and Trenton had a lot of Nazi yeah. skinheads, but didn't make it any less scary.
Yeah.
Like, you know, several times a night, somebody in a Hitler t-shirt would walk up to me and my friends to bum a cigarette. You know, like that's just, can you imagine that now?
No, I can't. But I mean, it was.
I didn't go to the bathroom for years.
Yeah.
I wouldn't go to the bathroom for years.
Yeah,
I'd go next to my car.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
Because there was always a couple of huge skinhead dudes that kind of posted up, leaning in the doorway of the bathroom,
mm-hmm.
like really big. Like in my mind, they're 8 feet tall. They're probably like 6'4", 250 pounds. But
which
like,
is formidable enough.
Formidable. Yeah. Not you know, swastika tattoos, Hitler shirts. Yeah, I mean, even at, like, shows that had no skinhead, you know, like, you'd go to see, like, The Exploited or SNFU
yeah.
or Dag Nasty or
yeah,
Agent Orange. They're always there.
Yeah.
It was worse for, like, Agnostic Front. And also, I started growing my hair long when I was in college. So I had hair down past my shoulders.
I remember going
to see Agnostic Front and feeling like me and Peter were the only... Peter was... friend from my town that I went to shows with who ended up being the other guitar player in Lifetime later on. But, I felt like we were the only people with hair in the entire place.
Mm-hmm.
We stayed in the back.
Is this the Sub Pop influence that was causing the hair to sprout from your head?
I don't know. No, it's more like, 'cause I was like, probably, self-conscious and awkward and wanted to like hide. Myself.
Right.
Didn't like my face.
You pulling a cousin it and pulling your hair in front of your face.
I had skater bangs too at one point before
yeah.
I grew my hair out. Yeah,
those, right.
yeah. But it was all about, it was much more about like, oh, I found a way to I found like a place where like punk style and my self-consciousness can interface.
Right.
So.
But you're vegan, right?
Mm-hmm.
When did you go vegan?
I'd already lived, when I moved here.
Moved here too?
Yeah. To Philadelphia.
Okay.
So you were... Which is 92, so when I was 24.
Okay. And what was the reason for making that decision?
I had been vegetarian, and I just thought... the more I read, the more vegetarian seemed like a half-assed solution to the mm-hmm. problem that I was concerned with. I mean, if we're talking about punk, I don't want to go into too much detail on that. I don't want to, like... to the lecture on veganism.
No, that's fine. I mean, just the basic idea. I mean, yeah. That makes sense.
Like, the dairy and egg industries are inextricably linked to abuse of animals and exploitation of animals, and I didn't think, like, we needed to feed ourselves that way, and I don't like the economy that emerged from that kind of dependency on animals. And,
mm-hmm. and were you concurrently straight edge?
Never straight edge.
Okay. So what did you, drink or...
Yeah, always drink.
Did you take nothing else.
Yeah.
So have you ever taken any drugs of interest?
Yeah.
Or, yeah. And I'm curious, like, sometimes people can have interesting experiences with, say, like a psychedelic drug that will
mm-hmm.
allow them to perceive life in a different way. And you don't have to discuss this if you don't want to. But did you have any kind of experience like that?
I'm not interested in discussing that.
Okay, that's fine. So let's talk about the beginning of playing in bands that you know, became to be well known? I mean, I guess Lifetime was probably the first, or was there something that was prior to that?
This is the first one that was well known. I joined a band when I got to Michigan called Cancer. Mm-hmm. There was like a crew of Filipino dudes that were all punks from the Detroit suburbs that had been playing shows for a few years already. And I joined, they needed a bass player. Yeah. I was the first non-Filipino in their band.
That's great.
Yeah.
And Cancer is a delightful name for a band.
Yeah, delightful.
What sort of music was Cancer?
It was punk. Okay. But they were moving more, and they were moving in a more melodic direction. I was moving in a more brutal direction. Mm-hmm. So we were like crossing at the wrong time, kind of. So we played together for like a year plus, and then kind of fell
apart. You saved the brutality for Lifetime.
Well, that was a few years later.
Right. So how to eventually you wind up.
Yeah, I think I mostly moved back to the East Coast because I wanted to be in a hardcore band. And I loved Ann Arbor, but, like, nobody wanted to play fast music. Like, even, like, I don't know if this is going to register for anybody or anybody remembers this, but, like, nothing personifies what was in vogue in Ann Arbor more than the Necros. Members of the Necros being in a band called Big Chief, which is basically like a grunge band. Mm-hmm. And that's what people wanted to do. Like, that's what people playing punk wanted to do.
Right, so there's a certain progression and make little arrows.
Like, nobody was interested in playing fast, mm-hmm. like fast beats.
Yeah.
I got jammed with a lot of people in the last few years I was there trying to find something that clicked. But there's nothing.
So back on the East Coast.
Yeah, and then the Necros had become Laughing Hyenas, which were a cool band. I saw them, like, so they were opened up for every big show and not so big show. But that's the, you know, if you think about, like, map the trajectory from Negative Approach and Necros to Laughing Hyenas and Big Chief, and that's what was happening there. So there's no way I was going to find people to play.
This is where the punk documentary ends, by the way. Yeah, it was 1986, and it was all over.
And it was all over, man. Yeah. It just, like, died, and, like, No, it kept going. But it actually got way more exciting, you know, my eyes in the 90s. Mm-hmm. But I guess we're going there.
Yeah, yeah.
I have to keep my eye on the clock, too.
What time?
I have to be in Ardmore at 1.
Okay.
So I should leave by 12:30.
Okay. All right.
Okay. So you feel free to, like, move me along if I'm, like,
no, I always like people to move at the pace that they want to move at.
I mean, because I want to get to Philly though.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, so let's go into the
move back to Jersey. So I knew I'd be able to find people to play in the hardcore band. Mm-hmm. And by then, it was also like, I was also a little freaked out by how, like, aggressive and violent the New York hardcore scene had become. And I had become enamored of, very enamored of Dag Nasty and Verbal Assault. Mm-hmm. A life-changing show was, Dag Nasty was like our Grateful Dead, my little crew of friends from Westfield.
Anytime
they were playing from the Anthrax down to D.C., we would go. Mm-hmm. But I only really knew about the big venues, you know, because it's like one friend in my town, you know, that was like, and then a couple of people that were like into weird music, but mostly just knew Dag Nasty and Minor Threat and weren't current. So I didn't know about people renting VFW halls and stuff like that. Like, and I didn't have access to that information very much.
I gotta interrupt you for one second. Yeah. I gotta give the mailman the mail, so I gotta pause this.
Do you not know how to pause it?
No, I can't remember where the pause button is. All right, I'll just, fuck.
Why don't you just run and give the mail?
You want to just talk?
You don't edit?
No, I don't edit. No. I know that. Wait. All right, this is part two of my conversation with Dan Yeaman because I can't use my own tape recorder.
We had been. It's because you just said something really offensive that we had to edit out.
Yes. Yeah. This is the first time ever.
There had been this one show. It was like, I believe it was an Agent Orange show, and the opener wasn't listed in the City Gardens thing. And then there's this rumor that Dag Nasty was going to open We'd already seen Dang Nasty like 7 or 8 times, but and so we went on the room based on the rumor, and Dang Nasty was opening, and somebody was passing out these flyers. There had been this like newer indie label called Giant that had signed a whole bunch of hardcore bands, and they basically did a new Dang Nasty record, a new Government Issue record, and a new Verbal Assault record all in the same time period. And they were doing a Giant Records like show at this place called the Lismar Lounge on Avenue A. And Lismar Lounge is a basement where my head touched the ceiling, and it's narrow and tiny, and it was Dang Nasty, Verbal Assault, and Government Issue.
So it was a very intimate experience.
Yeah, and it was like the next night, and we were like, fuck yeah, we're going. And that was my first experience of people handing out flyers for something I didn't know about at a show. Yeah. So we went, of course, and I watched Verbal Assault right on the cusp of Trial coming out, and that guy playing guitar made me want to play melodic hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
Like, period.
Right, yeah. And hence you did.
Yeah. So I moved back to New Jersey in 1990 with the intent of starting a band but also going to graduate school within the next year or two. And we started Lifetime, and we started playing, and I got so kind of sucked into that I didn't end up getting my grad school applications done the first year. So it ended up being another year. And I was living at my parents' house in Westfield and working in Elizabeth as a caseworker, social worker, and playing a lot. And we were practicing all the way out in Long Valley, which is like almost an hour northwest of where I lived.
Where some of the band members located?
Which is
up
where
there?
The drummer lived.
Okay.
There. Chris Staley lived there. And Ari lived down in Edison. I was in Westfield. So we were all like half an hour or more apart. Scott lived in Dunellen. And then did that for a couple of years, and then I moved to Philly to go to grad school. And really kind of thought I would have to stop playing music. And then, because I was going to a clinical program, we were taking 16 credits and the whole time, and in internship 2 or 3 days a week, depending on the year. That's a lot of hours. I mean, I know a lot of people work and go to school, but in college, I just went to school.
Yeah, yeah.
I just took up odd jobs when I needed to afford, like, a plane ticket or something, but... So I was like, I'll never be able to play music. And then somehow it just didn't stop. And Lifetime became much more involved.
I mean, the band seemed to pick up a tremendous amount of popularity over the course of its early life.
Certainly in this part of the country.
Yeah.
You
did tour, though, right?
Yeah. It was really frustrating at first because nobody, nobody was, like... People were not, like, particularly welcoming. Because what was popular was, like, tough guy stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like, trying to think, you know, who were the bands? I mean, like, I loved Sick of It All, but they were always playing with these, like, metal bands that were super scary to us. And that were all people, like, I think composed of a lot of people that were, at least reputed to have pretty violent history at shows and outside of shows.
Yeah.
And that stuff was scary to us. And
were you playing on bills with these bands?
No,
or so
no.
It was a completely, you know, concurrent.
Well, I mean, we played whatever show we could got, but we weren't playing with those bands. I mean, we were playing small shows and Ari had been a straight edge kid and part of Jersey's, he'd played drums in Jersey's first straight edge band, I believe, at least Enough.
What band was that?
They were called Enough.
Okay. Oh, no.
ENUF.
Yeah.
They just had a demo. And then he was in a band called Courage that was kind of one of the first, like, more metally influenced bands in like, Jersey hardcore. But, you know, by 1990, everybody was like, chin-chin-chin-chin-chin-chin-chin-chin, you know. And it was, like, the imagery was violent and tough and, like... And we were just like, and Ari, you know, was into all that stuff, and he'd seen Agnostic Front like a thousand times, and but he was like, I want to do something that's like so posy it makes Kevin Seconds look like a tough guy, and so we're like gonna put flowers on everything and like We're going to deliberately try to make, you know, create an imagery that would, like, the tough, that just, like, that would repulse the tough guys.
Yeah, this is a provocative move because it kind of invites a physical reaction to what you're doing.
But Jersey was, like, our place, and we had a lot of friends there, so we did a lot of, like, politicking around safety at shows, and somebody sent me a picture recently. They were at a birthday party. Somebody in their 40s, who's an old hardcore friend of mine, was at a birthday party in another person's house that was also in their 40s, and framed on their bathroom wall was this flyer I had handwritten in, like, maybe 1992 about, like, taking our scene back from the thugs and, like, policing each other at shows. And, like, I'd put my phone number on it if people wanted to talk or network. And, like, it's really funny.
Yeah, that's great.
I had forgotten that I did that. I was like, I would not stick my neck out. I don't know.
Well, I guess the phone number seems very intimate. I mean, in a time prior to internet. Yeah. And I guess you're also, when you're booking this tour, you're dealing with a pre-internet punk scene.
All by phone.
Yeah. Who had the dialer?
Dialer. First tour, there was no such thing. Afterwards, a couple of us had dialers.
Okay.
And then I moved to Philly to go to grad school. I went to Widener, which is down in Chester.
So what year did you get here?
92. August 92.
Right. Okay.
And
so you kept Lifetime going for some time. When did Lifetime cease, at least originally?
1997.
Okay. And then is there a time that you're not playing anything, or do you go on to...
Started Kid Dynamite immediately.
Immediately, okay.
Yeah, like when I got home from the tour that ended Lifetime and started finding people to play in the band with, because I was pissed off.
Right. Pissed off about what?
About people leaving the band.
Okay.
I had taken a year off grad school to tour full time, and halfway through that year, there were, like, other people in the band decided they didn't want to tour anymore.
Right. And then there's a point.
I was really angry.
Yeah.
Two of us had stepped out of academics to tour. I think Dave turned down something in the, like, artificial intelligence lab at MIT to go on tour.
Jesus.
And then, like, you know. At the people that I thought didn't really have much to rush home to were, like, the ones who were, you know, belly aching about being away from home.
Yeah.
It's all old news, and I don't, you know, I understand.
Sure.
I understand the forces that drive people crazy when they're spending a lot of time away from home, and I don't resent anybody for that.
Sure. Yeah.
But time, I was furious and disappointed, heartbroken, all those things.
What part of Philadelphia did you come into? Where were you living?
I lived, the first 3 years, I lived within a few blocks of University of the Arts.
Okay.
So 17th and Pine, 16th and Waverly. 17th and Lombard, 16th and Waverly.
Did you have experience with Philadelphia prior to moving here?
Okay. None, I'd never been here.
So what were your...
It was always reputed to be too scary. Everybody said, and you went here, so, you know, you can call it fiction, but the reputation Philly had was, yo, you think City Gardens is scary? Like, check out Pizzazz. So not interested in anything scarier. And also I was told that Atlantic City skinheads were a big force.
Yeah, oh, that's absolutely true.
And so I didn't, you know, I was already like, I was comfortable at City Gardens, like comfortably uncomfortable. But because it was a known quantity. And I would drive to the Anthrax and stuff, but, like, I'd never come to Philly for a show.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. And it's certainly, it was a main reason why Bull and Chris Rye and other people and I started Cabbage Collective. It was in reaction to...
Which saved my life, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
Because at first, it was just the only thing visible to me was... What's that spot in Old City with the pillars that was doing shows?
Oh, Revival.
Yeah, there was a Revival. Yeah. And occasionally some big show at the Troc. And then still City Gardens for a little while. But again, I had not been part of a community of kids up until then, so I didn't know about VFW shows and, like, stuff like that. I didn't know about kids. I didn't know about DIY.
Right.
I knew what Discord was, but I didn't know about aside from that, the notion. I don't think it really hit home that Discord was just, like, two guys that wanted to celebrate their scene.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like something, and when you're a kid, like this vast network of something, you know, beyond your own.
It wasn't until I, like, didn't really understand the network until we started doing Lifetime. And, like, I started, like, meeting people out of town and pen pals and calling people and visit. I had some friends in the Boston area that I would just, like, visit, go to shows for a couple of days, come home. Some friends in D.C. I moved here, and I used to go down to shows at St. Stephen's in D.C. a lot. This is pretty close. Mm-hmm. And we had made friends in D.C. and Richmond, so it was
because the Positive Force folks were doing things down there.
Those people and other people. And then I was going up to Hiltz's.
Right, yeah, the Hiltz Hotel.
Yeah, God, that. And then the Cabbage Collective.
Yay.
First at the Calvary, right?
So you went from the very beginning. Then.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay, great.
Yeah, so transformative experiences, UOA at the Calvary Church.
Oh, yeah, amazing.
Like, life-changing. And I mean, we can do Philadelphia area, right? Like anything's relevant.
Sure. Yeah.
So, like, let's talk life changing and DIY. Universal Order of Armageddon at the Calvary. John Henry West at Hiltz's basement. Life changing.
Yeah.
Forever raised the bar that I'm still reaching for.
Yeah, there is a level of physical intensity that those bands brought.
And political.
Yeah, for sure.
But physical intensity, yeah, definitely. And like and something ephemeral. Like they didn't care about lasting. They just cared about like burning bright.
Yeah.
And I'm still reaching for that bar set by those two shows.
Yeah.
The music I can get to, the physicality, I'm maybe a little too old to go for that, but it might be why I play music with people 10, 15 years younger than me a lot, too. I don't know.
So some years into this, then, you wind up having a physical issue, but you died.
I did not die. That's dramatic. That's a big leap, though. The 90s.
Oh, well, let's talk a little more about the 90s.
The 90s, like, I don't want to talk about Lifetime and Kid Dynamite as much because I think they've been talked to death.
Okay.
Unless there's something.
I'm more interested. I'm never really that interested in the specifics of people's bands, but more like their general thoughts. So, your thoughts on 90s would actually be very enlightening, and I'd like to hear what
you. That was the height of, like, enthusiasm and activity and like the DIY in the world of DIY, you know, like we entered in, I felt like we entered into this world that was entirely created and managed by the kids, by punks, like didn't like nothing cool happened in a club. I feel like for the bulk of that day.
Oh, I agree completely. Yeah.
Every once in a while it's exciting to get asked to play a show at the Troc, but ultimately the things I remember were not. The things I remember were a show your brother did in the Drexel basement of the Drexel Student Center.
What show was that?
Lifetime, Tintinnabulous, maybe Adam and His Package, Pi United, maybe Policy of Three. It's a fantastic show.
Yeah.
Fake House shows. Oh my lord. So, Bikini Kill and Team Dresh at the Fake House. A Veil at the Fake House.
Yeah.
Citizen Fish, I think, at the Fake... Didn't Citizen Fish and Spit Boy wreck the Calvary for a little while? Or the kids wrecked the Calvary?
Yeah. Well, that was the last show there.
Yeah. For a while.
That was the last show we did at Calvary.
Yeah. And then the church. And then
But 40th in Baltimore. Right. And then we went to Unitarian. Well,
right.
Actually, we went to Stalag and Fake House and like other places and wound up in Unitarian.
Did Unitarian come after Stalag and Fake House?
Yeah. Sometimes things were concurrent depending on the show because of the relationship was tenuous. And I have kind of a bad memory on these things. But there was a definite end at 48th in Baltimore with the Citizen Fish Spit Boy show.
Yeah. Because the kids were terrible at that show.
Yeah, because there were a lot of people who came out who didn't have an investment in the scene and didn't really know what we did.
Just punks with an X, just fucking shit up.
Yeah, who were drinking outside and doing graffiti. And none of the people who came to the shows prior to that would do any of that kind of stuff.
If it had just been Spit Boy,
Yeah.
I don't want to cast aspersions.
No. It was
just the way that community appreciated the value of the spaces.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought. Maybe I'm idealizing.
I think you're exactly correct. No, so, because they were very plugged into that. I mean, it's
and
not.
Spit Boy was like a DIY feminist punk band.
Yeah.
And
the punks people, don't want to drink to right, the, Spit Boy and right, the, scribble on the wall.
There might have been some people drinking, but they would have hidden it.
Yeah.
And if it had, but, you know, Sizz and Fish brought out, like, you know, people that were into the Subhumans, which was, like, kind of predated, you know, a scene that created and cared for itself. I mean, maybe in England, that's what that came, what the Subhumans were part of. But
yeah.
I think the people that were Subhumans fans in the States were, like, a little more into, like,
anarchy and chaos.
Yeah, chaos.
Yeah, yeah, and chaos was not really a part of what we were doing. And also,
well, it's not conducive. Like, he can't.
It's purely destructive and creates nothing in its wake. Yeah. I mean, I think that people like that coming into a show like that are happy to sow the seeds of chaos because with no investment, it just doesn't make a difference. They had a good time, and if the place closes in their wake, what do they care?
Yeah, that's like the nihilist punks. It's so much about the moment that, like, it can't be about the future of the community.
Yeah, exactly. We're all going to fucking die anyway, man.
Yeah. And, like, I had already, you know, I had, like, done that with in the 80s. Like, I thought we were all going to die. You know,
yeah,
and, like,
yeah.
And,
yeah, by the
90s, nihilism's not attractive to me.
No.
It's anti-human.
Oh, I agree completely, yeah.
And I'm a humanist.
Yeah, I mean, looking
so, like,
for
it. Romanticizing the humanity's self-destructive nature is not interesting to me. It's like fighting it has been interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like fighting against our self-destructive nature is what punk is about for me.
Yeah, no,
if I had to be reductive.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the Cabbage Collective, man, that was life-changing. Cabbage Collective and Hiltz.
Hiltz, yeah.
Like that was just the 90s for me. And even when there were big shows, there were those festivals that, like, kids would rent, like, a big place and do dance for 3 days, 4 days, work, and then workshops and stuff. And, like, even though some of the workshops got hippie-ish and heavy-handed,
yeah,
it was still, like, realizing the idea, like, trying to more fully realize the ideals of punk. Like,
yeah,
it's more than music. It has to be significant.
Mm-hmm.
But
I think you bring up a really good point, which kind of dovetails into the reason why a project like this exists, is that in a lot of these documentaries that end in, say, you know, 1983, 85, they kind of miss this era where, like you said, the kids finally took over, like where these ideals came to fruition.
Punk actually got better after you dropped out.
Yeah.
Maybe it wasn't as dangerous or new,
yeah,
but it got better.
Oh, I agree,
like,
completely.
There's by the kids, for the kids, is way cooler than, like, Fender's Ballroom and, like, gang members and, you know, like, and people getting the shit kicked out of them. And security and, like...
Yeah. And the need for security. Even.
Yeah, the
like,
need
there's
for
there's like, Nazi skinheads aren't coming to shows like that because there's nothing there for them.
Yeah.
And they're clearly not wanted. So there's no need to have a thug at the show to propel these forces.
To propel the other thugs.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's like, I wrote a set of lyrics that I have not yet used about, like, having to hire thugs to protect you from thugs, and it's called What We Learned from Altamont.
Right, yeah. Apparently we didn't learn very much because it keeps playing itself out over and over again. Although, I think here in this, you know, in the scene, it's, you know.
And it was countrywide.
Yeah. That I think those ideas spread really well, almost like the 100th Monkey or something, where all of a sudden everybody realized that it can be done.
I feel like everybody was either doing a label, doing a zine, or at least really invested in traveling and communicating, doing shows. Like, maybe not everybody. I mean, there were some consumers, I guess, but, like, it felt like, or a distro, like everybody wanted to participate.
Mm-hmm. I think that, and there was also a welcoming atmosphere for people to participate because the spaces allowed folks to set, you know, if you had a thing, you were welcome to set
to
up
set
and sell
up?
The thing. Or,
exactly.
Yeah. And I think those ideas have kind of spread going forward.
Yeah.
Even, you know, that it's kind of almost a given now.
Yeah. I mean, there are things I miss about that era, but I feel like it's still a lot of that has persisted. A lot of the best aspects of that have persisted. Mm-hmm. I mean, the basement scene in Philly. Just look at that. I mean,
yeah.
When in the last, like, 10 years, there have always been, like, at least half a dozen and more houses at any given time that are doing shows regularly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is something like an ongoing venue.
Yeah, no, it was something that came up in some of the interviews when I was talking to younger folks, was that for people who came into the scene when R5 was fully operational mm-hmm. and was providing some level of punk shows mm-hmm. on a regular basis yeah. in a clean, safe environment for a reasonable yeah. price, would they lose, in effect, some of the ethos to do shows on their own when it was there being presented to them where it wasn't available in other parts mm-hmm. of the country? And fortunately, younger folks... Mm-hmm. did still want yeah. to do that.
As R5 became big enough that, like, it wasn't satisfying all the needs.
Yeah, yeah, like, yeah. Like, you get afraid, or at least, you know, maybe mm-hmm. there was a concern that a link would be broken mm-hmm. if a certain generation wasn't actively involved right. in doing shows because they were so well mm-hmm. presented.
Right, because it was too easy. It was easy.
Yeah, yeah. But clearly not the case yeah. because it's a shit
I think it's good that R5 got big. Because R5 still represents doing things the right way
yeah,
and
absolutely.
Having a variety of scale. I mean, they still... We'll do shows, you know, that are like, you know, 150 capacity, but have the access to doing shows that are 1,200 capacity and, mm-hmm. and are still interested in doing the range across genres of independent music. And I think that's great, but they're too big to satisfy the need, and the need's there, which is great.
Yeah.
So now we have the basement scene.
Yeah, and the basement scene is
vibrant, fantastic. Yeah,
yeah. And people move from house to house, yeah. and kind of the shows move from place to place.
And there are always a couple of houses that become like the be-all, end-all, like almost like the new Unitarian Church. Like,
yeah, yeah.
You know, it was the Terror Dome. I mean, it was Stalag. Well, the Stalag, I guess, preceded the church, but like the Terror Dome for a couple of years, Golden Tea House now. Yeah. Like, not to take anything away from the other houses that are working their asses off to make stuff happen, but... Every once in a while, someone finds a space that's so conducive to, like, a really great sharing experience, you know, mm-hmm. where the sight lines are better, you know, like, basements are cool, but unless you're the first 10 people, you can't
yeah.
see shit.
Yeah.
You get sucked into the energy of it, but, like, every once in a while, someone finds a space where they're like, oh, we can do this on the first floor, and we've got this living room that works
mm-hmm.
where everybody can kind of see, and you can actually fit, like, 200 people in here. And, like, still have no stage, and, like, and it's just kind of perfect. And yeah. I feel like every couple of years there's another one of those, too, and it's great.
Yeah. I guess when you're aware of these things and to some degree involved in them, it kind of allows you to avoid a sense of nostalgia, like, oh, things were really great back in this year to this year, and then, you know, nothing matters after that.
Yeah, I think that kind of nostalgia is really destructive.
No, I agree. And I'm sure you know people who are sort of mired in that.
I'm not interested in talking to them about music. It's just irritating.
Because you know that there's always a period at the end of the sentence. Like, music will end at a certain point. So it's kind of a very finite
conversation. But if you pay attention, there's, like, cool stuff happening. I'm not, you know, like I said before this was turned on, to some degree, all history is revisionist history.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's all about narratives and point of view and perspective and, like, you know... Different people were there that felt different things, saw it from different angles,
mm-hmm.
saw it through the lens of different ideologies, and all those stories are the truth, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's their truth.
Right.
Or a truth.
Yeah, it's a truth.
A truth among many.
So, I don't say the truth with capitals.
Right.
Like, I mean, it's the truth. It's you can say a truth.
Yeah, I think a truth kind of works.
I think there are always multiple truths,
mm-hmm.
right? It's like, which direction was the lens pointing? The lens is covering, at best, like, what? 20 degrees of a 360
degree. And there's all this shit going on over here.
Exactly.
You know, everything out of frame.
Mm-hmm. That story's not being told, except by somebody else that was somebody else. So, like, all those truths are important. But the revisionist history that tells the story of it just ending is, like, bullshit. It's self-serving, jaded, like, things were cool when I was young, now things aren't cool. And young people can't be doing something as cool as what we were doing,
mm-hmm.
which is horseshit. Because if you pay attention, it's happening.
Yeah.
And I think I think people tend to remember certain styles, and I wish they were remembering other styles. You know what I mean? Like there's an experience I've been having a lot lately where I hear about a band or I talk to some young person that's in a band, And I'm like, oh, what's it like? And they're like, 90s hardcore. And I'm thinking, like, Torches to Rome. I just think Mike Kirsch or Sarah Kirsch, you know, and Nation of Ulysses and Fugazi and Universal Order of Armageddon and Crudos. And they're thinking, like, Chokehold and Trial, which is fine. Yeah. But I wish, like, there was as strong a memory for the other stuff amongst people half my age. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for the same reason. But memory doesn't always help because everybody remembers the Gorilla Biscuits. But when people do an 80s hardcore band, they inevitably want to ape the Cro-Mags. Uh-huh. Right? And so, like, even though everybody remembers GB.
Yeah.
I wish more people did bands that sounded like Gorilla Biscuits.
Yeah, yeah. Although it seems like it would even be better to do bands that sound like them, you know, rather than looking back constantly to create, like, the 2013 version of this band that they never saw.
Total recreation, I'm not interested. I guess heavily influenced by what I mean.
Yeah. So you now, you're in your 40s, you have a very professional job. I mean, you could say that you're...
I'm a clinical psychologist. Right. I'm not a child psychologist.
Okay, yeah.
I see adolescents and adults.
Okay.
In private practice.
So this is, and you have two children and a wife and a home in Philadelphia. So clearly, you know, you have an extremely professional life, and yet you have this spark of vitality and interest in these things. So how is it, you know, you've retained this throughout the years. It seems like you've always had a very searching mind, like a very active, enthusiastic
mind. Curious.
Yeah, yeah. So, and you've managed to retain this curiosity, which I think is really great because, you know, I'm sure we both know people of a similar age. Yeah. We're almost the same age.
Because music's exciting.
Yeah.
There's nothing more exciting. I mean, my children are exciting. Mm-hmm. And sex is exciting. And music's exciting.
Right.
Like, people making things is thrilling. And sound, loud sound, people struggling to invent something... Or even just to recreate something cool, you know, which is exciting to me. Mm-hmm. There's not much more exciting than that. So, but it's also still always punk has stayed, at least DIY punk has stayed continuously. Like, it's remained something that values ideas on an equal level as sound. And that's exciting.
Yeah, I think that ideas are really something that can keep you drawn into this thing, as well as the sound, because they can be so vibrant. And
it's the sound of birth to me. Mm-hmm. And I've witnessed birth twice.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a thrill, and that's what new music is like. It's the sound of birth.
Right.
And how can you get tired of that?
I have no idea.
Like, I don't get to go to shows very often because... I'm tired, I work late, I have a family, and I have band practice. So I'm not taking more than one late night out a week.
Yeah.
Basically. Because my body can't really do it. I'm not as resilient as I was. Because kids wake up even when they sleep through the night, just to clarify. Maybe you get lucky and you have a kid that wakes up at 8 or 8:30. My kids both, even once they've started sleeping through the night... Waking up, they wake up at 5:30, and that's really early. It's horrible.
That's when I get up in the morning.
Yeah,
just like one of your kids, because I run. But
it's the worst thing ever. I mean, it's not conducive to going to shows, even shows that end by 11.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, wah. But when I go, it's a thrill. You know, like going to a show at the Golden Tea House is thrilling. Mm-hmm.
Super. So I guess in closing up things, do you feel that any of the values and ethos that you've derived directly from punk play any role in your parenting? Like, are there certain ideals that derive from the ethos that maybe you instill into your kids, or are they even, you know, are they vegan?
No. I'm
vegetarian?
They're vegetarian, although, you know, we have some arguments about that. My wife's not vegetarian anymore. And she's worried about, like, you know, them getting all their protein from soy. So be really careful to make sure that doesn't happen.
Do you not want your son to develop breasts?
Just, like, not healthy. I mean, I worry about it for myself, for whatever reason. You know, like, so, you know, spend a lot of time making sure they're their diet is balanced, their protein is balanced between like soy, eggs, beans. I try to instill, it's less about like this dogmatic like lifestyle politics and more about, which by the way, I'm, you know, being vegan, big fan of dogmatic lifestyle politics in some ways, except like, you know, when someone's out, when someone else,
I can't really talk right now.
When someone else is pushing theirs down your throat, then it's no fun, but, that should be a little funny into it. No, more about curiosity and excitement and engagement. That's like what our parenting is about.
Mm-hmm.
And fairness. But you can't all, you know, nothing seems fair to a 2 or 3 year old, you know, like if they don't get to do what they want to do, it seems unfair.
Yeah, then you're the figure of authority, but you rule with a fairly benevolent and thoughtful hand. So.
There's a lot of thought into how you manage parental authority and how you view it. So we put a lot of thought into the distinction between authoritative and authoritarian.
Mm-hmm.
Very different things.
Right.
I think kids need an authoritative voice. You know, like there's certain things that just are not okay. They're not safe. My job's to keep you safe.
Mm-hmm.
But within the parameters of that job, we have a lot of freedom. And maybe we can negotiate. Maybe this thing isn't safe if you do it by yourself, but maybe if I hold you, it's safe enough.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff. And I want them to understand why things that aren't okay. I want them to understand why they're not okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's bad to default to because I said so when you have to, because sometimes you're in a rush, right?
Yeah,
sometimes
you can't just have dangerous. A discourse about.
Yeah, and sometimes you don't have time for a discourse, or it's like bedtime or time to go to school. But like in general, when there aren't the constraints of like time or immediate danger, I want them to know why something isn't okay.
Mm-hmm.
I want them to know why we don't eat animals, but mommy does. You know, right. Like, don't sidestep those things now, because you can say, like, mommy doesn't believe the same thing exactly about animals that daddy does, but this is what we're going to do.
Yeah.
You know? And when you're older, you can decide for yourself, but for now, this is how we're going to do it.
And it seems like, you know, you said you live in a house filled with books and records and things
books
like that.
Records.
So, yeah, so you have, you know, the ideas are there. Yeah. That your
ideas
can,
are there.
Yeah.
We go to the art. We're within walking distance of the art museum.
Yeah.
Remembers. She loves, my daughter loves the art museum. My son is a little bit of a destructive force, so it's hard to, we haven't gone as much since he's one.
Mm-hmm.
But we would go, like, weekly up until he was born for her first 2.5 years. Just curiosity and engagement with the world, you know, and like digging up worms and exploring in the forest and collecting leaves and listening to music and making noise and seeing what sounds things make and exuberance and curiosity.
Yeah, yeah. I think that those are probably the best seeds, yeah. You know, that you can plant in anybody's head and see what kind of, you know, beautiful plant's going to grow out of their brain.
And point. Negotiation, too. Like, she's somehow children's music snuck into the house, even though I said it wasn't going to happen. Because
right.
I've watched certain friends lobotomized by children's music. But, you know, now there's children's music in the house, you know, she wants to hear certain stuff. And I said, well, we're going to alternate. You know, we'll play a kid's record and then we'll play a daddy record or a daddy and mommy record.
Yeah.
And, like,
does she gravitate towards any of the music that you listen to?
She sometimes says, like, I want to hear yelly music.
Yelly music, yeah. Any particular bands go over well?
We had one particular babysitter that taught her about Minor Threat and Black Flag specifically.
Wow, you had a cool
babysitter. And so she would just be like, sitting around playing with blocks, and she'd be like, Daddy? I'm like, what, Simone? She'd be like, Minor Threat.
Yeah.
Like, fuck yeah. It's awesome. No, we've had pretty exclusively, not deliberately, but pretty exclusively punk babysitters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can explain, like, what guilty of being white means to your 3-year-old?
No. Not messing with that quite yet.
Wait till 5.
I think, you know what, I'm gonna say this. This is, like, breaking with canon, but I think Mekhi should have apologized for that song. Not apologized for, like, who he was at the time, but, like, it's a little dopey in retrospect. And he's so unapologetic, maybe not apologize, but sort of like been like, you know, there's obviously a more mature perspective on this experience.
Yeah, this isn't teenagers. I mean, I don't know exactly how old he was, but, you know.
But he's so unapologetic. He's so determined to not apologize for anything.
Yeah.
That he kind of, that's the one place he ends up making a monkey of himself. It's like, you know, like sticking to his guns on that song.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I guess we'll, it's kind of odd to end on that as the
Yeah,
as the
maybe
ending.
Not. Can we, like, can we not end on that? Yeah, I mean, but I don't know. I can't say what it's been like in other communities, but Philly, I feel like, has been really strongly committed to keeping that, like, DIY torch passed along.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I think there are kids doing just as exciting stuff now as when we were kids.
Yeah, no, I would certainly agree with that, yeah. And it's nice, you know, when I've spoken to them or, you know, been at events like that, to see the vibrancy retained through the years.
Oh, and I just remember my first South Jersey show was the Harlan, which was you. Were you involved
me,
in that too?
Yeah,
you and Bull.
It was me and Bull and Chris Fry. Yeah.
And Chris Fry.
Do you remember what show that was?
It was like Lifetime and Policy of Three. I think.
Okay.
Oh, no, it was Matter of Fact.
Matter of Fact. Yeah. Yeah.
I have the Matter of Fact demo. The Hand.
Yeah. Jesus Christ, you remember that? Yeah. Yeah, people were kind of from the show slam dancing in the little narrow aisle between the roses.
It's very
seats.
Cool.
Yeah. Wow, that's so cool that you were there.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah. Well, excellent. I mean, I really appreciate you talking to me.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to not wax nostalgic.
We didn't really talk that much specifically about the bands that you were in. I don't even think we said the name of Painted Black, but...
It's been Lifetime, Kid Dynamite, Painted Black, and then another band I'm working on now that's very much in the style of... The two shows I referred to earlier that were life-changing.
Yeah.
I'm doing a band now with Andy Nelson and Chris Wilson that is very, very much in the vein of
those Dag Nasty, Verbal Assault?
No.
Or Universal.
UOA, John Henry West.
Okay, yeah, Jesus. But I'd love to see.
We're just looking for a singer.
Yeah.
And it'll be good. But that's the next wave.
That sounds great. Yeah, it is. It's tremendously impressive that you've been in three such big... bands, you know, over the years, over a span of time.
Yeah.
I think there are a few people who can say that they were in bands that were so distinct and yet so, you know, gained so much popularity and remained within the ethos, you know, within...
Let's hope it's because I love punk and not because I'm a narcissist. Or at least some, like, sort of benevolent combination of the two.
Well, you wind up creating something that means a lot to people, and I think that that's really what matters. You know, benevolent or narcissist, I would say that ultimately what matters is what you produce, because people are going to know you more from your work than as an individual. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, what it really is I can't stop making music. And I don't... I love a lot of different kinds of music, but I am not interested in playing anything that isn't, like, loud and boisterous.
Yeah. And this is good for all of us.
It's good for me. There's plenty of people making quiet music.
Yeah.
Not enough old people making loud music.
I would agree.
So, yeah, I think it's a good thing.
All right, super. Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.